Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. Today, I have the great pleasure of interviewing a former guest, Jen Vogel. And Jen has graciously come in to talk about being a highly sensitive person and how it has led her toward actually being a very skilled psychotherapist. There are two basic motivating forces: fear and love. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, excitement, and acceptance.
Coming to you from our studio in Santa Barbara, California, this is the Fear Me Out podcast. We're not your typical self-help program. Our show takes a deep dive into those psychological issues that affect us on a daily basis. We hope to shift your perspective and have you experiencing emotions differently. Now, Dr. Dana Saperstein.
I can't speak about Jen highly enough. I had her on a previous episode to show people what a good therapist looked like. And now I want to show the world what being a highly sensitive person looks like. And you're a great example of that. So thanks for coming in, Jen.
Thank you for having me. I think being a therapist and being highly sensitive actually go hand in hand.
Yes, they do.
I think that's probably a requirement.
So tell us a little bit about your life as far back as you want to go and how being highly sensitive affected you as a kid, even though you didn't really maybe intellectually understood that that's what you brought to the table.
Sure. You know, you and I have talked many times, Dana, about my sort of my beginnings, right? My mom was a teenage mother, so I was a little love baby for her, but which put us in sort of a cocoon together quite a bit. And so my mom's a very highly sensitive person, always has been. And I've been told by my grandparents that she was highly sensitive since the time she was little. So I came into the world and knowing that highly sensitive people, as we are looking at them now today, is that they are, you know, biologically kind of constructed towards being sensitive from the beginning, right? And so I guess if you have the environment and the biological predisposition, you're probably double whammied to be very sensitive in the world.
Yes.
And I had both of those things, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did your mom know that she was really sensitive and that she gave birth to a highly sensitive a little girl?
Well, you know, I think back in the, what would that be, the late 50s, early 60s, I don't think there was as much information, like sort of psychoeducational information,
right,
that gave them sort of that information to work with. We have that now, but I don't think she had that. I think she always was very emotional.
Okay.
Very easily triggered, cried a lot, felt deeply, wanted to fix things. She was one of those kinds of people anyway. And I think I, as a little girl, picked up on those things and saw that as sort of normalized, right?
Did you feel like you were able to read her pain and that you felt a sense of responsibility to take care of her from the beginning?
Definitely.
Okay.
I think that's a highly sensitive person trait.
Yes.
But I also think it's me, right? It's her and I, my dynamic. And I think a lot of parents and their kids have that dynamic.
Uh-huh.
And we don't realize that until we're older. We just sort of become this sort of unit that functions kind of cohesively, right? Homeostasis.
Yeah.
It's what she needed from me, and it's what I needed from her, and the two of us sort of gave each other that that sensitivity that we needed, I think. Problem is we couldn't probably figure out who the parent was and who the child was sometimes, right?
Well, that's the problem.
It is.
You end up being, you don't get to be a kid.
That's right.
Because you end up being the parent to the parent.
That's right.
And that's really common for people that are really highly sensitive as children, is that sense of anxiety of wanting to make sure that your mom is okay so that you can feel safe.
That's right. That's right. It kind of builds in that,
yeah,
that immediate, I'm aware something's not going well and I'm on high alert. And so there's that sort of that, in a sense, a little trauma too, a little fight, flight, freeze. Like, how do I fix this for her?
Uh-huh.
And her for me as well. So we did that together, I think, with each other, but we weren't probably always sure who the child and who the parent was at the time.
And do you feel like you were successful at easing her pain?
I do.
Because that's really unusual. Most kids grow up feeling like they failed miserably because No matter how hard they try, there's not enough space inside of them to take enough of their parents' pain to make the parents okay.
It's funny you use the word try, and I never felt like I was trying to do something for my mother.
Okay.
I think it was a natural built-in response because I had the ability to do it.
Oh,
and so
okay.
I did it. I don't think I was supposed to always have to do that.
Okay.
Right? I don't think children should have to do that.
Right.
But I think I had sort of a maturity from the beginning as well that
okay.
allowed me to sort of take it on and then fill that role, okay. which has, as of late, been a problem because I'm realized I needed to be a kiddo
yeah.
when I was a kiddo. And I didn't get that opportunity sometimes to have okay. that. So I have had to go back and kind of treat that little person inside me with some care
okay.
around that. But yes, I think I felt like I could do it because she said that I did it.
Oh, okay.
Right? So my mom's very verbal. She would say, you have changed my life. You have made my life wonderful. You coming into the world was one of the greatest things that's ever happened to me. You know, so all those kinds of words being put out at a little person makes you feel like, oh, I have a purpose. I'm helping my mom's life be good.
So it sounds like her appetite was not insatiable, like a lot of parents.
Yes.
A lot of parents have so much pain that no matter how much is siphoned off.
That's true.
It doesn't make a difference because their pain is so intractable.
And, that's true.
And they're so insatiable that you fail miserably. But mm-hmm. it doesn't sound like that was part of your experience.
Didn't feel like I failed, but I definitely felt like I needed to continue my role, if that makes sense.
For?
To make her life out okay.
Forever?
Probably. I think I still struggle with that. I think I still go, how can I fix things for her so
for
that
your mom.
Things are easier for her? Yeah.
Okay. So you still feel a bit of a sense of responsibility.
I do. I think I do by sort of a, by default. I go to that even today as an adult. I still go to that, but I know better.
Okay.
Now I know I'm a highly sensitive person.
Okay.
And that's a trait that I have. And I do that probably with more than just my mother because she trained me to do that.
But you don't sound resentful, Jen, if I can interrupt.
Yeah.
You don't sound resentful about sort of being elected as the pain manager in your family.
Yeah, I don't feel resentful right now. I think I've gone through a lot of that. I've gone through a lot of therapy. I've gone through times of being very angry and not knowing why.
Okay.
Sort of unpacking some of that has kind of led me back to this, well, you know, wait, where's my chance to be like taken care of? Where's my chance right. to have somebody
right.
sensitive to me?
Yeah.
And then when people are, it's uncomfortable for me. Because I've been so trained.
You're not used to it?
I'm not used to it.
So again, being a highly sensitive person, it feels really good to give.
Yes.
And very uncomfortable to receive.
Correct.
Yes.
That's really
I
a good point.
I can totally appreciate that.
Yes. It's like, I don't know, this doesn't feel right. I'm uh-huh. okay. You go on your way. I'm okay.
Right. I can take care of myself. Thank you very much.
I can take care of myself. Thank you very much, which I had done.
Yes.
Right?
I do know that. I've known you for a long time.
I know.
And I know how good you are at taking care
I know.
Of yourself.
I know it. Almost too good.
You know, when I think about your experience, it's kind of amazing to me because you are really, truly the first person I've ever met that doesn't carry a ton of resentment about being elevated into a parental role so early in your life.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like your mom was able to kind of take care of you a little bit in return.
Yes. Yes, okay. For sure.
Because, I mean, I know that in my relationship with my mom, I started taking care of her before I was born. And I spent my whole life, all the way till I was in my 30s, feeling like she was a parasite feeding off of me.
So you knew you were doing it?
Not as a little, well, I mean, I have memories of
yes.
her believing that she was ugly when she was pregnant with me.
Yes.
And my taking her pain on, feeling responsible for the fact that my dad was having an affair. Uh-huh. And
But all of that internalization of hers was sort
and I
of
took
shared.
It in. I mean, I remember feeling through
this
my umbilical cord.
This little highly sensitive like, baby.
Oh, it was awful. And then I was born not able to be get nutrition from her.
Mm-hmm.
So right from the beginning, I knew that my job was to make sure that my mom was okay.
Yeah.
The problem is the difference between our moms is that my mom was never okay. She never had an okay moment in her entire life because she was so traumatized and saw herself as a victim on such a deep level.
Yes.
That her appetite was insatiable.
Yes.
And I really remember so many times feeling like it was my responsibility to make sure my mom was okay. I didn't feel it consciously, but I just had this feeling like my mom would not survive if I didn't take care of her.
What's interesting, though, about your experience is that you talk about it in terms of knowing that that's happening, that she's sort of sucking on you in a way that you're not able to do or that you don't want to do, right?
Well, I didn't realize that, though, until I was in therapy and came to understand that.
Yes.
That it was a very unhealthy relationship. And I realized that I actually had a couple friends, women friends, that I was doing the same thing with, mm-hmm. that I was their caretaker it. Rather than their friend.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came to the realization in my 30s that this was incredibly unhealthy, I got a divorce from my mom and I got a divorce from these other women. And I actually put a stop to it. And I don't think I've ever done it in that way since then.
And that's dramatic.
Well, because it was really awful. I mean, to feel a parasitic relationship with one of your parents is really horrible.
Yes.
I mean, it's like, I know where the vampire thing comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, she didn't suck my blood, but she sucked my energy on a really deep level.
Yes, sure.
And I know that that happens for a lot of people that are sensitive, that
yes.
they bring love to the table. Mm-hmm. And the person who has no love and doesn't feel like they deserve it mm-hmm. goes to look for it in one of their children. Mm-hmm. And usually, in a Jewish family, it's the firstborn male.
Well, and it's in it, yes. And it's interesting because you're talking about her in a different way than, you know, I think of my mother, right?
Uh-huh.
That parasitic idea, it's there, but it's sort of an unknowing on her end
uh-huh.
rather than a choice that she could have changed, I guess.
Right.
My mother's a very loving woman.
Yeah.
But there is a needy emotional self that's uh-huh. under that. That's sort of an innocence.
Right.
But I ended up sort of falling into this role with her that later I went, oh, I can't do this. I am like exhausted.
Right.
I'm just exhausted. And uh-huh. so, you know, there's many things in life that are, I'm caretaking around anyway. So
yes.
it just sort of amplified everything in time. And I went, I don't want to be highly sensitive. I want to be a caustic, mean, vicious, like protected, right?
That's right.
I want to encapsulate myself and put my superhero yes. thing yeah. on and fly away and
uh-huh.
but I don't do that.
Yeah.
But I want to sometimes. And I think that's sort of my, at times, my self-realization.
Well, and you're also a much kinder person in a lot of ways than I am because my role was to be incredibly rebellious and super Whoa. Violent as a kid to overcompensate for the sensitivity.
Gotcha.
Because anytime I looked at a kid that had a look of sensitivity in his or her eyes, I wanted to hurt that person.
Yes, yes.
And so my friends and I fought constantly
yes.
and really violently. We lived this like middle-class Jewish neighborhood, beating the crap out of each other all the time.
I love it. And you're just working it out, right? You're just working stuff out.
You know, my friends' dads were so encouraging of us fighting. It was so bizarre.
Well, that is, but that was the time.
Yes, it was.
That was the time. Yeah. It's like you just go, if you're going to go beat them up, really uh-huh. beat them up. Don't yes. like just do it halfway.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's so true. There's as an anecdote as well, there was an experience I had in my master's program where uh-huh. they, and this is a little sidetracking, but not really. There was a course on projection and they said, okay, what we're going to do is out of all the cohort that you have, and we had 30 of us that were in class, you need to choose one of those people that you have this projection issue with.
Right.
And in doing that, I didn't want to do that with anybody.
Yeah,
that's my sensitivity. That's a really,
actually.
Really dangerous thing for a highly sensitive person
yeah.
to even want to involve themselves in and wonder if it would get out and if she would find out. But there was one gal, honestly, that drove me batshit crazy. And I could not figure out why.
Yeah.
Because she did nothing wrong.
Uh-huh.
She was a very nice, sweet person.
Uh-huh.
But every time she would open her mouth, I would go, I just wish she would just stop talking.
Wow.
And I would want to walk away. And I thought, there's wow. something really activating about her.
Yes.
And so later, as I was sort of discovering and unpacking and writing and doing all kinds of things around it, I realized, oh, this is really me feeling like I have to mother her.
Oh, okay.
Right?
So that there resentment was this, showed up.
Yes. So that whole thing showed up. And I thought, okay, that's interesting for me to yeah. note that because from my beginnings, either from an unconscious or conscious way, my mother sort of required me to mother her.
Right.
And here I'm going through life and I'm recognizing I don't want to be everybody's mother, which
right.
is a great thing for me to recognize.
Uh-huh.
And now I have that little sense and I go, I'm out.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
There's way, way more boundaries that I can put up now because I know that'll just suck me in.
You know what's funny, Jennifer?
What's
when
that?
I refer people to you, mm-hmm. I say to them, if you have any issues in not feeling loved by your mom, this woman will help you heal that pain.
It's going to be in there no matter what.
Because she is the most maternal person I've ever met in my entire life.
Yep.
I tell people all the time, I wish she was my mom, even though she's younger than me.
I can be a mom too, Dana. I can do it. I can do it.
Because you come from such a place of love. Mm-hmm. And I know that your clients probably feel really well met and really loved in a very maternal way. But that's healthy. Because
I have
been
told that, yes.
That's professional.
It is professional. Yeah. Part of me wants to resist what you just said because I went, I don't want to be everybody's mom. You know, I don't want to be everybody. Well, I don't want that job anymore.
Well, I'm not saying that you need to take them home with you.
Right. No, and it's so true. But you use what you have, right?
Yes.
And you learn the boundary. And I think highly sensitive people have to continually figure out how to find their edge so they don't walk over the edge.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
Sure. So when you were in junior high and high school, what were your relationships like?
I knew that I was number 9 on the pecking order of 10 girls.
Number 9?
Number 9. I was in the 10.
Oh, you were? Okay.
Oh, yeah. I was in the 10, probably the top 10 girls.
Okay.
But I knew I was number 9. So if only 6 people were invited to a birthday party, I wouldn't be there.
Oh.
I wouldn't be invited. But I knew I was in it, but I would have rather have been number 3.
Yeah.
Or 4. I didn't want to be number 1 because they kind of, I never could figure out why they were number 1.
Yeah.
They were actually kind of bitchy girls that got to be number 1.
Yeah.
So maybe the highly sensitive ones ended up at the end of the pecking order.
Yeah.
But I was sort of at the end of the pecking order.
Was it lonely?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you do remember being.
I remember not being in high school picked to be in a club.
Okay.
A lot of them were in clubs. And I was sort of on the outskirts of that for some reason. But one club said, you know, instead of Jennifer being in the club, why don't we make her pledge mommy?
Oh.
Here we go. And I thought, what's pledge?
I'm sorry to laugh,
what's
but that,
pledge
that's
mommy?
Funny.
And the pledge mommy was the one who would make sure that nobody was being pledged too hard or too brutally. I would have to report them and say, you know, you can't feed them things that would make them throw up. You can't stick them in a trash can upside down. You can't hurt them.
Okay.
And so my job was to protect everybody. but then I got into the club by being pledge mommy.
Oh, okay. Because
super sad.
One of the things that people tell me regularly, and I'm sure you hear this also, is that how come people don't like me? Mm. Why do people avoid me? Why are some people willing to be my friend, but I'm never the number on the 1, 2, or 3 list?
That's right.
I'm always less than that because
bridesmaid.
People avoid me. It's hard for me sometimes to find friends that I enjoy. And my response is, well, yeah, because you scare them because they don't want to be seen for who they are.
That's it.
Right? Everybody's got secrets.
Yes.
And usually the people at the top of the pecking order have the biggest shameful secrets and they overcompensate for pretending to be something that they're not.
That's right.
And if you can see through that, you're a big threat to them. And none of this happens on a conscious level. So you're going to be kind of ostracized. Mm-hmm. And it's such a relief to people to understand that it's not because they're not likable. It's because they're scary in a certain way.
It's almost like see things.
Yeah,
right?
Because when you walk in a room and you can read the room, there's a lot of people in the room who prefer not to be read. Right?
That's right.
They don't want that.
That's right.
So, you know, you walk around as with a big magnifying glass, magnifying everybody's either okayness or not.
That's true. That's true.
And that's difficult. If you don't understand why it's happening.
That's right.
It can make you feel like there's something really wrong with you.
Well, and the other thing is, I don't think you, from a social standpoint, I don't think I get all the jokes right away either because I'm pretty literal about them.
Oh, okay.
Right? So you're thinking a lot. I think highly sensitive people are always thinking deeply.
Except for me.
Except for you. You're highly sensitive, but you're like, you don't think deeply. But you do.
I do in a way, but I was really lucky that my dad, despite being a nut,
that's true.
Had an incredible sense of humor. He loved to joke. And
Got
so
it.
He taught me how to make fun.
How to be irreverent sometimes.
And for some reason, it comes really easy to me to joke with people. A joke always pops in my head.
Yes.
If I wasn't so shy, I could have been a comedian, except that, you know,
yes.
going on a stage, they don't make diapers big enough. So
right?
That's never going to happen for me.
I get it.
But, getting back to junior high and high school, it sounds like some of the highly sensitive stuff was kind of getting in the way a little bit in a way that you didn't know.
Yes.
So what about when you went to college? And you got married pretty young yourself.
I got married the first time, when I was just 20.
Okay.
turned just 20. I
think, and what drew you to your husband at that time?
He was funny. That's really funny. He was kind of humorous and funny, probably sort of a little opposite of me. He was not highly sensitive at all.
Okay.
I liked it that he stood up to my mom, which is interesting. He would argue with my mom and he would stick to it.
Oh, okay.
And he wouldn't back down. And I remember looking at him going, I wish I could do that.
Oh, okay.
Right?
So you're envious of his ability to...
So there was something about the detached nature, a little bit of a detachment from having to be responsible to make her happy that I witnessed and I enjoyed
watching. That makes sense.
Loved it.
So that marriage lasted for...
Almost 25 years.
That's a long time.
A long time.
So what do you think...
I'm only 40.
What's that?
I'm only 40.
Well, so you're definitely a child bride.
I'm teasing. That's a joke.
yes. Were you aware of sensitivity during any of that period of time?
Oh, for sure.
So you knew
I was
that
told
you were
oftentimes by him even, oh, you know what? You're too sensitive. Don't let that bother you so much.
But that's not a positive
message. It's not a positive message.
That's a shaming message.
That is. And even my young boys, you know, as they grew up and would say the same thing to me.
Okay.
Mom, you're just a little bit too highly sensitive, but that person was probably not real nice either. So there's like this thing you have to sort of arrive at, you know, you might have had this thing, this moment with somebody that made you feel bad, but you're a little too sensitive and they were probably not being sensitive enough.
Oh, okay. So you were shamed into submission.
That's right. Okay. It's like you sort of have to reevaluate, just let things roll.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't a positive.
No. No.
Not at all.
No, I think in an unconscious way, I was trying to be less sensitive also in that relationship.
Well, yeah, I mean, anybody that's different than the norm.
Yes.
Definitely feels like there's something wrong with them. Yes. Especially if you don't understand.
That's right.
And made to feel ashamed of that characteristic.
That's right.
So what
and that relationship didn't last, right?
So what do you think brought an end to that relationship? Did it have anything to do with being a sensitive person?
No.
No?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think I think when you're a highly sensitive person and you're with somebody who's not at much at all, there's not a lot to share in that regard.
Oh, okay.
There was almost a detachment from.
Oh, okay.
It's almost a lot. And you know, I have an autistic son. I very well could be even that his dad had some autism or a little Aspie.
That's what it seemed like to me when I met him.
Yeah. It's just a little detached. Uh-huh. And I think, so you never feel like you're really close to somebody.
Right.
Either.
Okay.
Which was a dramatic thing. But I think at the time when I chose him, for that reason. Because it wasn't so immersive for me.
Oh, okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, you wouldn't be required to save him from himself.
Not at all.
And to
didn't ever feel that way with him.
To do what you did for your mom.
That's right. That's right.
That makes sense.
Yeah. But I remarried. And I married a sensitive man.
I do know that.
Yes. So it gave me that opportunity, though, to be in a sensitive relationship without having to fall into something where I lose myself.
Okay. Right? So when did the concept of being HSP become a conscious thing for you, not in a shameful way?
Funny, but like a couple years ago.
Okay.
As a therapist. Okay. Just understanding the concepts, it sort of has come up, you know, just sort of collectively in psychological circles, and it's been talked about way, way more in the last 5 to 10 years probably. But I really became sort of more aware of it, and I could see my clients in it. I could see myself in it, realizing that I had to manage, really the key to it was really that I had to manage my energy.
I'm not sure what you mean by that. Can you elaborate a bit?
Yeah. So if you're a highly sensitive person, you're taking in and absorbing like a sponge. You're just taking in everything. It's like walking in a room and knowing that this room in the corner over there, two people are not getting along and you can see it. You can see it. You don't know it, but you can see it.
You can feel it.
You can feel it. You know that this isolated person over here is not having fun. They're not here. They're not enjoying themselves.
Right.
Someone over here is being very loud and obnoxious, and you know you're going to kind of stay away from that energy maybe because it overwhelms you.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of navigation, I think, when you first come into a setting, but that all is absorbed in the body.
Okay.
And your body is taking all of that in, and it made total sense to me because I thought, I do that.
So did you read something about it and then say, oh, I get this, I understand this, or how did the intellectual information become part of your
part
understanding?
Of it for me, I cannot remember, Dana. I can't remember where I heard it. It could have been a podcast. Could have been a book.
Okay. But as soon as you got the information, like, I'm assuming that a bell rang inside of
it. It did, completely. I said, that's it. That's exactly what I deal with all the time.
Were you upset?
No, I was relieved. No.
Really?
Because, very relieved.
Oh my God,
because
I can't tell you how angry
it's biological.
Some people
get. I don't want to change this. You know, it's just the way it is.
I mean, there's a lot that we can't change, but that doesn't mean we don't get mad about it.
Yeah. I wish I could be more water off a duck's back. I wish I could be a little bit more quippy and less sensitive to things at times. Yeah. I wish that I wasn't overreactive to being in a room full of energetic people. I wish I didn't have to go and take the next day off and lay in bed and rest all day long because I'm overwhelmed.
Okay.
There's that sort of, and part of this is introversion as well. So you have to sort of keep in mind that that's part of, I think the story is that there's a little bit more leaning towards introversion.
Okay.
And sort of self-soothing and being able to like manage the energy that you just expelled by having to think so much about everything that's going on around you.
You know, I'm astounded that you're saying these things because you're also a very successful actress in the past. How did that happen?
Yeah.
How did you get,
I think that was the need to self-express. I do. I think that was a way for me to be in another character and to get all of that out in a different way.
But walking,
and I love that.
Standing in front of an audience, I mean, to my mind, I'd rather jump off a bridge.
Yes. And you know, I think a lot of actors and actresses are introverts.
Really?
Yes.
I don't think something happens when you get on stage.
You're allowed to be an extrovert.
Because when I've seen you on stage,
it's a very short time.
But you seem so comfortable and so vibrant when you're on stage.
I think I'm comfortable with relating to an audience. I don't think I would be comfortable being a film actress at all.
Oh, okay. So you like a live audience?
I think the room, I'm having a relationship with someone else in the room.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's a whole nother thing. I did a whole video on that, is talking about the third in the room, and that's the exchange between you and the audience. And the audience gives you something, you give it something, and there's an exchange that happens live and in person.
Okay.
That you don't get in film, but you get it in the room, in a live room.
And that feels really good to you.
Totally. And every night's different.
But it doesn't like tweak your nervous system too overwhelming.
It has to. You know, you have to. And if it didn't, you wouldn't do well. Oh, I mean, you have to sort of have the nerves. Yeah. I'll be back there jumping up and down and, you know, doing arm, like hand jumping jacks. And I'm trying to get the energy like focused.
Okay.
Yeah. Because there's definitely nerves. But once I'm out there, it's like it just.
So remarkable. I'm actually jealous because it looks like fun.
You can do it.
Well, that's what people say.
I'll help you.
But that's what people say who are really good at something and they take it for granted.
I know.
Oh, you could sing.
I know.
And my response is, if you heard my voice, you would run.
I tell people all the time, I can't draw. I can't translate something from my eyes to my hands.
And don't they tell you, oh, it's easy.
Oh, you're just not seeing well. And I'm like, oh, yeah. And then they'll go, oh, but I can't sing. And I'll go, oh, you're just not hearing well, right?
Exactly.
There's always a reason. But yeah, some people are inclined to present. I think when I, at one time, Dana, this was back in probably junior high, I got into a class as an elective and I got into a speech class.
Oh.
This is kind of where it started, I think.
Okay.
And the speech class was just getting up and giving speeches, like about anything that you felt. And I did one on, I think it was the wife of a Vietnam vet.
Really?
Who had lost him in war. He had died in war.
Wow.
And she was writing a letter about the effects of that in her life.
This was high school?
This was junior high school.
Oh, that's pretty serious stuff.
And it was when a lot of that was going on. So it was the tail end of that and sort of the MIAs and POW thing was sort of big. And I remember doing this speech and people were sniffling in the audience.
Crying.
And it was a competition.
Wow.
And I got this award for this speech I delivered by communicating this in a way that moved people. And I remember going, I love moving people.
So that felt really good.
That felt really good. And I think from that, I think it bit me at that point. I went, I enjoy helping people feel something.
So again, the way that I sort of digest what you're saying is that I always would thought that actors and actresses did it for the adulation and to service their ego. But what it sounds like for you is it's an act of service.
I use my highly sensitive person stuff.
Yeah. So for you, it's another version of being of service.
It's translating humanity to humanity.
Wow.
It's giving, helping reflect people's humanity.
That's so different than feeding your ego.
It is different than feeding my ego, which I get a little ego from it too, though, right? So it's always lovely to be applauded and told that you did a beautiful job. I always know if I really did a beautiful job or not, but that's my self-judgment. And I would go, oh, no, it wasn't that great. But they don't know that because they didn't see yesterday's, right. Which was really good. Yeah. But I think there is that sort of storyteller aspect to my life that I've always wanted to sort of tell the stories.
Okay.
And oddly enough, but not oddly enough, is I'm often cast as the narrator.
As the what?
A narrator or the storyteller aspect of
interesting.
A lot of performances. I've been sort of that storyteller.
So for a reason.
Yes, I think it's something I like to do. I think that's my most fulfilling stuff is when I get to narrate the story and sort of tell the journey. And
so you're a born therapist.
I think I was a born therapist. And and we have to note this for the audience too. My mother is also a therapist, so she's really good at it as well, from what I understand.
Okay.
Probably better therapist than maybe even what our dynamic was.
Okay. Right? A few minutes ago, you brought up something that's extremely important, which is what are you supposed to do in the face of other people's pain when you feel it so acutely?
Sure.
Because everybody I know that's highly sensitive has to figure out some way of managing what they get from the outside so that it doesn't take them down. And most people are taken down by it. They feel burnt out, overwhelmed.
Yes. I think this is where, and for me, this is sort of how I take this. There's a lot of comparisons between highly sensitive people and empaths.
Right.
And people talk about them like they're one and the same. And I have a different view of that. I feel like an HSP, a highly sensitive person, is biologically born sort of inclined that way. I think we just have that in our cells, right? I think an empath oftentimes is trained to be empathetic, which means you feel what another person might feel in a given moment, like putting their shoes on. Like you have this sense of knowing what they're going through.
Right.
And it's a skill, but it's a gift as well. But I also think it sometimes is a gift by default, and it doesn't always come in a way that's actually healthy. I think that, and I think I use the example when you know that your father is coming home and he's got a lot of different moods and you don't know what he's going to show up as. Will he be angry today? Will he come home okay? Will he not? There's a sort of a preparatory sort of sense that in your body, there's like a sensory motor kind of response that goes, I'm going to be ready for whatever I see when he comes in the door. I'm going to be watching for his mood. And whatever his mood dictates, I will become what I need to become.
Okay.
So that I make things easier for him. It's a little codependent stuff too.
Okay.
But I think as a highly sensitive person, we have an ability to do this. I think we learn to be more empathic when we learn to survive things sometimes.
So it's really a coping mechanism.
It's a coping mechanism
to keep yourself hopefully feel safe.
For sure.
But again, what do you do in the face of how much pain that you invite into your life? How do you manage? Because anybody that comes for therapy is not calling you up because things are going swimmingly well.
Right.
Right. Sure. I don't get many professional phone calls when people say, oh, I just want to come see you to say hi.
Yeah.
Right. No, I'm suffering. That's
right. Yes.
Right. And I specialize in the deepest trauma a person could suffer. And so the amount of pain that comes my way could theoretically squish me flat, but it doesn't. Mm-mm. So before I talk about my coping mechanism, I'm curious about how you handle, as an HSP, how do you handle other people's pain? Because you can't not notice. It's impossible. Everywhere you go, you're like you're a walking sort of, knowing what's happening around you all the time.
Yes.
So how do you personally handle the pain that you encounter on a daily basis?
Well, I use both of those skills, right? So we're talking right now specifically about HSP and empath.
Okay.
I'm an empath. I've learned to be an empath. I think being empathetic is something where I can join somebody.
Okay.
I can feel the feelings.
Yes.
I don't think we can take someone across the bridge to another side of themselves without joining them in the empathy.
Okay.
If that makes sense. I use that as a tool as well. Compassion. Compassion.
Yeah.
So for me, if I'm going to want to move a person over into sort of more skills to like sort of coping skills and strengthening their resilience to things or recognizing triggers and being able to sort of manage triggers.
Okay.
I'm going to need to join them first on the compassion side in order to bring them over.
Compassion is not the same thing as taking their pain into your body, unless it is.
Well, is it? That's a great question. That's another whole episode. But I think compassion and empathy go hand in hand. I'm not sure they're the same thing.
Okay, well, I mentioned it to you because people ask me all the time, as I'm sure they ask you, how do you do your job and not be taken down by it? And I don't know that people believe me, that it doesn't take me down, it lifts me up.
Right.
But the reason it lifts me up is because I don't take even a molecule of a person's pain into my body.
Mm, I see what you're saying.
Because I was given a gift a long time ago of a dream that I had where I was trying to figure out what God's role was in my life. And part of what I was told in the dream is that if you accept me, I will always be there with you. And you don't ever need to be afraid because I'm in charge of the pain. You're not. Mm. You're in charge of being the human representative of helping people recognize their pain and where it comes from. But it's not your job to alleviate the pain from people. That's my job.
Yeah, lovely.
So that sweetness.
Tremendous and that resource. Gift was,
yeah, because now I realize that I can be in the presence of as much pain as a person could possibly carry, but it doesn't take me down. Because my job is to help you recognize your pain and to show you ways that you can let go of it, but not by taking it in.
That's right.
Because if I take the pain in, it's very disrespectful because it indicates to the person that they're not capable of managing their
own
pain. That's
right. And that's what I was going to say too. I think there's that idea that do I believe that people heal and can heal and have all the resources within them to do that? Yes, I totally do. I don't carry it home either.
Okay. So maybe we do the same thing without realizing it.
Yes. In the moment, I think I can feel it in my body.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Of course it makes sense, but I don't even let it go that far.
Because that's great.
What I remember as a little kid,
yeah.
when they used to get your temperature taken, right? Mm-hmm. You have the glass of the moment or up your butt, because that's how old I am.
I remember that. No, I remember that. I'm
very painful.
Yes.
And they used to leave it in for like minutes. And I think to myself, oh my God.
3 minutes, I think.
So humiliating, number one, and dangerous.
Yes.
Because who wants mercury up their rear end?
You have to be very still. If they break
the thermometer, right?
That's right.
And now, how long does it take a person's temperature?
Oh, I know, right? You just sweep over your head. Yes.
Yeah. I think that's all it takes to measure a person's emotional pain.
Hmm.
So when I plug into somebody, I just have a second of connection to what's happening inside of them, but very quickly take out the thermometer because I don't need to reconfirm what their temperature is emotionally. I just trust what I get. And then it's sort of off to the races from that perspective of me trying to help you understand that there are ways I can help you release the pain.
Yes.
And you don't have to have a spiritual life or have any life or belief in God or any of that stuff. It doesn't matter because...
Do you think that your clients feel that you feel that, at least for that moment, implicitly?
Well,
I mean, we don't know, right?
I tell people all the time.
There's a sensitivity about that.
Well, I tell people all the time when I'm teaching them not to be absorbing people's pain, that they're not doing the person any favors by taking their pain in.
Sure.
That's left over from being a little kid.
Sure.
And feeling really scared and unsafe. And so the more you take in, theoretically, the safer that you feel because you're putting out the fire that's surrounding you.
Right.
But as an adult, you don't need to do that anymore. Mm-mm. It's not necessary. And so what I try to teach people is you can read somebody in a second.
Yeah.
And you don't have to take anything into your body. It's like maybe when you get your temperature taken, nothing comes into your body.
Well, it's interesting that and I was just sitting here thinking about how the things from that are in their body, their client's body.
Yeah.
That feels emotional or it feels torn or it feels hurt.
Yeah.
I always associate that to their child.
Uh-huh.
I always do. And I think I do want to go get the child,
uh-huh.
and I do, and I'll say I can be with you in your child right. place, and then we're going to bring you over into the words, which is, you know,
yeah,
after, you know, pre-verbal,
uh-huh.
like age. So sure. we're going to now talk about things like an adult. I'll be with you in that too.
Yeah,
but I might go get you and might feel that child with you for a right. minute. But we're going to bring her or him over.
Okay.
We're not going to stay there.
Right.
For sure.
Okay.
And I think that's probably more of it. I'm seeing her trying to imagine how I do that when I say take uh-huh. them over the bridge.
Sure.
It's join them in that place that hurts so much.
Yeah, it's just
so
a different way of saying the
that's
same thing,
right.
I think.
And then bringing yes. them over. And when I'm done with that 50 minutes or 60 minutes,
uh-huh.
I'm
yep.
I'm not caring any of it.
Well, and the other thing that people, I don't know if they say it to you because you're not a man, but men often say to me, you have the biggest box of Kleenex I've ever seen. How do you handle people, so many people crying in front of you? I hate it when people cry in front of me. Like if my wife or my girlfriend or whoever, boyfriend
they don't like
cries,
the tears.
It That's just so sends me into orbit. It scares me so much when somebody cries in front of me.
I forget that.
Because I feel helpless.
People, yes. And that is so far from what my experience is. I don't, tears to me are very genuine.
Right. So my response to that is when somebody cries in front of me, I take it as a compliment mm-hmm. that they feel safe enough to bear their soul in my presence.
That's right.
So to me, it's a gift, not a liability.
That's right.
And it's not up to me to make their sadness go away. Like a lot of men feel, oh, I got to take care of this.
I got to fix it.
Make yeah. it better. That's not my deal. My deal is to help you come to terms with whatever yeah. it is that you need to come to terms with so that you can develop a sense of competence and
that's right.
and understand that you can heal your pain, and you are not your pain, because I think that most people believe that they're their trauma and their pain.
That's right. That's
and
right.
And that's really sad, because we're not our pain and we're not our trauma. Those are things that happened to us or didn't happen for us, and they don't have to define us for the rest of our lives.
That's right. That's right.
Because I can talk about being sexually abused and, you know, all yeah. the other
horrible
shit
that
happened
to me. You can
get
really, really attached to it, right? You can get so attached
to
that.
I don't feel any connection to it really on an yeah. emotional level anymore.
Yes. Yes.
Because I feel like I've been able to let it go.
Right.
So I figure that if I can do it with the horrible stuff that happened to me, why can't anybody else?
Mm-hmm.
All you have to do is understand that it's not you.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't cause it, and it's not your fault.
That's right.
And there's no shame in talking about it.
That's right. There are times where it's hard to do this, but there are times where people uh-huh. identify so much with the trauma or the
yeah.
with their pain that they'll keep bringing that in. And I've actually asked them to come next week. We're not going to talk about that at all. And uh-huh. we're going to talk about other things, not to ignore it. It's going to be in the room with us, but we're not going to just delve into that. Right. So anything but that, if it's their kids, sometimes uh-huh. it's just, they only talk about their kid. You know, it's like, okay, next week we're not going to talk about them
right.
at all. And it's tricky.
Well,
but you are more than that. You have more in your life going on than that right. for sure.
And I'm not trying to say that's not important, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
I think that dealing yeah. with trauma is the key to
for sure.
finding love and connection yeah. in your life.
Yeah, release. You know?
So I do think it's important. But I also yep. think it's really important that people understand that, number one, if they're HSP, don't take people's pain into your body.
That's right.
Because it will ruin your life.
Yes.
And ruin all your relationships with the people that you care about.
That's right.
And it's left over from being a really scared little kid.
Yes.
And so it's not really necessary anymore once you realize mm-hmm. that you're not a helpless little kid who has to put out the fire.
Right.
That's because right. the house is definitely on fire. You weren't imagining things.
No.
They were just sitting around, you know, roasting marshmallows. And you're like, oh, what's wrong with
Oh my
you
gosh,
people?
Somebody, we got to save
place
these,
is on
we
fire.
We got to save this place.
Oh, yeah. Don't worry about it. We'll just get another marshmallow.
Yeah, you know, right.
Have another drink or whatever.
If only. There are times, I don't know if you do this, but there are times where I've said, I wish I didn't have a clue.
Have what?
Have a clue. Sometimes I wish I just didn't notice everything.
You know, I guess I'm too old to have that wish anymore because I know it's too late.
It's too late. It's just when you know too much or you feel too much, it's almost like, or so much, I shouldn't uh-huh. say too much. There I judged just right then. I just judged. Well, but when you take in so much,
yeah.
sometimes it's just nice to go, God, it would be so nice to not notice anything. Like, I'd love to go into a party and not notice any of that and just show up and be me, right? And it's like, not worry about.
Yeah, but Jennifer, that's easy for me because I don't go into a party.
Oh, there we go. Just don't go to parties. That's a self-soothing or self-managing.
I'm not a very
HSP-ness.
I'm not a very social person yeah. in that regard. I cannot yeah. bear superficial yes. conversation.
Right.
So I manage
and
it
that's
by...
And that is an actual yeah. symptom?
Yeah, I don't put myself in the position
yeah,
of...
Yeah, dumb conversations are right, not...
Right, unless I have to.
Yes.
And because I'm really lucky because my dad taught me how to joke.
Perfect.
And it's really important, I think, as an HSP person to learn how to make fun of yourself.
See, there we go.
Because there is no shortage of weirdness.
That's right.
That you and I possess.
That's right.
And I don't feel like that's a bad thing.
I
actually,
I love that.
You know, when my kids or my wife or anybody makes fun of me, I take it as a compliment because you know what? They're right. They notice that I'm weird.
They're right. And they're, yeah.
And how do you fight it when you know it's true?
That's right. That's right? Right.
Because I am really weird and who cares, right?
It's nobody part of, cares.
It's part of my
my differentiation.
Charm, right? That I'm a weirdo.
Yes. Yes.
But
yes.
It's also difficult because I know that people avoid me sometimes. And I don't think it's because I smell bad because I bathe no. regularly and I try really hard to have good hygiene.
And they avoid you because they think that they're being seen.
Well, I've had people say I've that cleared out rooms just by telling people what I do for a living.
Oh, yeah. No, don't
it
never do
that. It happens all the time. It scares people when you tell them that you're a therapist. It makes them uncomfortable.
Yes.
Because who doesn't have secrets that they're ashamed of?
Right.
And some people, I think, really find it interesting and fun to talk to somebody who wants to know
yes.
who they are.
Right.
But most people would rather drink it or work it or
yes.
eat it or whatever away.
That's right.
So then you have a lightning rod like yourself who walks in the door and they think, holy shit, I got it away from this woman.
Right.
She scares the crap out of me.
She's going to see stuff. Yeah.
Because that's the difficult part of being really sensitive is that I think people can tell, maybe not consciously, and people that have things to hide will definitely avoid you.
That's right.
Because they can feel that you can see them and they don't want to be seen.
And that's a nice segue to the idea of, I know we talked about you doing another podcast on, you know, lying to yourself, right?
Yes.
The idea that so many people in the world do that. I mean, and I mean that in a different sort of way than I think maybe you were going to do the podcast, but the idea uh-huh. of lying to yourself
yeah.
is a way of sort of avoiding the pain.
Oh, absolutely.
That keeps you from the thing you really want,
uh-huh.
right?
Yeah.
And so when somebody walks in a room and you feel seen, it's almost like, oh, I can't get away with lying to myself with yeah. this person in front of me.
Well, so, and the hard part is that sometimes it can be a bit lonely.
For sure.
I used to go surfing in Mexico all the time, and it was with the same people every year for years. But there were not people who lived where I lived, so I'd only see them twice a year
right.
for a week at a time.
Right.
And there was always four guys, and we all sat at a big giant table, and there were 18 of us for dinner. And never once would any of those four people sit anywhere near me at the dinner table.
Oh, wow.
I don't think that they were consciously avoiding me, or maybe they were. But because I pay attention to everything, I always noticed that even if there was a seat next to me, they'd walk around the whole table to sit somewhere else. Yeah. Because not that they were bad people, but I think that they were afraid of what I might
I think
notice.
My husband goes through that too.
And it's not...
He has the same situations yeah. happen.
Because the people that I would sit next to, we would have so much fun because I would tease them and,
right.
you know, we'd all give
then
each
everybody
other.
Everybody wishes that they had sat by you the whole time.
But there afterwards. Was always a psychological component to it.
Oh, interesting.
You know, and I mean, men are generally pretty rude to each other when we're
right.
fun and there's no women around. yeah. So, you know, all these things would come up and I would yes. say to people, you know, you just don't know it, but you're in the closet. Right? Even though you got a wife and kids, it's so obvious that, you know, that you've never come to terms with your sexuality.
Yep.
And, you know, we'd be laughing and having a fun time and all that stuff.
But, yes.
I think that some people just get really scared when they feel like they're going to be exposed.
Yes.
And there's good reason, because I really do believe that if you and I went to the grocery store, as an example, we could probably figure out what kind of trauma the person standing in front of us carries in their body.
Probably.
Because most people advertise their trauma without knowing they're doing it. So there's good reason for people who don't want to deal with it to avoid people that see
That's
it.
That's true, right? Then we don't have to take it so personally.
I don't take it personally because I know that I'm somebody that's not easy to have as a friend or you know, to be around because I want depth and I want connection.
Right.
And I don't have a special sports team or actor. None of the stuff that people really love appeals to me, so it makes it hard for me to figure out what to talk about on a superficial level, if that makes sense.
Superficial conversations are really hard.
But they're not for most people. I think most people live in that world, and they like it.
I can do it, but I don't like it.
Well, I can do it
because I need to.
Right. I was watching college football the other day, which I really don't care that much about.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by a team that lives in Alabama. Because when they have a football game at their stadium,
right,
90,000 people in the stadium, 50,000 more people in the parking lot, all dressed in red.
Oh, that's
Crimson funny. Tide. And yes. They live and die for their football team.
Yes.
And I think to myself, boy, I wish that I could have something in my life that was that meaningful on that superficial level. Because mm-hmm. it would make life so much easier to live and die with my football team mm-hmm. rather than live and
it's
die
It's sort of
with
that collective thing that you have on the outside of yeah. you rather than anything internal even.
Yeah, but I can't do it, right?
It's just hard to do, yes.
The only thing I wish is that Alabama will lose, but that's because I don't like the coach.
There we go.
Because he seems like a dick to me.
There you go.
Right? But that's it's good. Super once simple. Again, we're on the psychological yes. level, right?
And then you go, where are those guys that think that like right. you, right? We got to find that cohort somewhere.
You know, they pay the guy $4 or $5 million a year to make sure that the team wins.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's we're getting funny. A bit off the subject, but
no, it's interesting.
So you decided to become a therapist uh-huh. after working. You were working in as a.
I was working in technology.
Yeah, I know that you were. What was your role in the company?
Oh, well.
You were in marketing, right?
I was in marketing, but I was a client service. You know, I was basically a client. What did we call me at the end? I took care of clients and made sure they were fine.
So
I would call them and make sure that they were happy using our product. And yeah. I would get testimonials, right? Uh-huh. I would get their story
right.
about success.
Yes.
And if they didn't have success, I'd find out why. And I'd find someone to help them so that they did find success.
Right.
So that I could get a testimonial.
Right.
Right. So really it was, you know, in marketing, it's like you're wanting to have an honest.
Sure.
Evaluation of yeah. your product so that you can use it for all your marketing materials. So. But I would also follow up with people who were not happy.
Oh, okay. So you probably
became the mother again.
You're probably quite popular in the office of people that will come to you and want you to be their therapist.
Client relations specialist. That's yeah. what it was. That's what it was. And it's really, yeah, calling clients and just knowing uh-huh. our clients, just knowing yeah. them as people. And so I would go to, you know, events and I'd sit down with people and say, hey, how are you doing? How's your family?
Right.
Right? How's your business? But how's your family too? Uh-huh. Like, I want to know all of that. So I've been a therapist my whole life, I think.
So what made you decide to do it formally?
I was doing it anyway.
Oh, okay.
I was doing it there anyway. A lot of employees would come in right. and they would walk into my office all day long and they'd uh-huh. say, can I throw something past you for a minute? It's personal. Do you have a minute? And I'm like, well, actually I just used all my breaks already for like three other people, but yes, come on in. And so people would come in and shut the door. And I realized, I thought, you know, my mom had always said you'd make a great therapist and I didn't want to do anything my mom said. So I thought that idea like vigorously.
Well, and I remember talking to you about it and telling like, you how good you would be at it.
Oh yeah. And so I finally realized I can't pretend that this is not happening. And I never had finished my schooling and I wanted to do that. So
right.
I went back and thought, of course, this would be a natural thing for me to do. I'm doing it anyway.
Right.
May as well.
So how do you feel? I mean, do you like being a therapist? Is it fun?
I do.
So you feel like you made the right choice?
Oh, for sure.
And how much is your HSP a function? I mean, a gift in your therapy practice?
It's a gift because I'm aware of it and I know where to use it and not use it,
okay.
if that makes sense. I'm a little
sure.
bit more, I can actually bring it in. I'm also very aware of the fact that it's not useful at times.
Okay.
So I'm using it when I can and I'm not using it when I shouldn't.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
And what about teaching your clients who show up and they don't know that that's why they've suffered so much or one of the reasons?
I think it's a great relief to people when they find that, oh, there is an actual thing.
Yeah.
This is an actual thing I was actually born with.
Yeah.
This makes so much sense. No wonder I didn't want my parents to leave me at kindergarten the first day and I
right.
couldn't like stay in the class for right. all day because I was overwhelmed.
Yes.
And they go, oh, this may, I've been beating myself up for being such a wimp, you know, all these years. And yeah, it's nice because people have something they can kind of hang their hat on and right. go, all right, this is going to be something I'm going to address in myself probably all the time.
Okay.
And
the relief is palpable when somebody comes to understand that they have no choice.
That's it.
And it's
a gift.
There's
something lovely about that. Yeah.
Well, because it makes you more capable of novel solutions to problems.
Sure.
And it makes you more creative.
Sure.
But it also requires you to be more careful about who you give your heart to.
Yes.
And I'd like to talk just a tiny bit about that before we finish, because if you're not careful who you give your heart to, you can fall in love with somebody who's not healthy for you and become really strongly attached.
That's right.
Because when you're HSP, there's no middle ground in terms of how deep that you care and feel about whatever you get attached to. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that you've noticed.
Oh, big time.
That you got to be, it's not a question of trying not to be sensitive. It's a question of honoring that sensitivity.
That's right.
And making sure that you vet the person out that you're giving your heart to before it's too late.
That's right. No, that's true.
Because everybody I know that's HSP, the kind of love that they're capable of feeling is so overwhelming sometimes.
Right.
Because it's like life or death in a certain way.
That's right.
That when you really fall in love with somebody, you don't want to live without them.
Right.
Even though you know that you probably would.
That's
the
right.
feeling is, I don't want to live without you. I mean, I certainly feel that way about my wife.
Sure.
I'm assuming you feel that way about your husband.
That's right, yeah.
He's a very lovable guy. Mm-hmm. And I could, you know, both you guys,
yeah.
I can't imagine how you could live without each other.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a scary way to live, right?
Yes.
It feels good, but it's certainly scary.
Yes.
And I know for you and my wife, who has to deal with guys that are physically not so well, mm-hmm. it's doubly scary because, you know,
that's
you
right.
kind of look sideways. Are you going to be okay? Right?
Because like what does this look like down the line?
Are
we worrying about? Yeah. And that's, you know, that is something that has been really good about finding out that I'm a sensitive person.
Yes.
I also realize that I'm also a very capable person. And so I'm trying to sort of foster that stuff a little bit more intentionally.
Right.
Than I used to. One of the signs of an HSP is that they fall in love really quick.
Yes.
Right?
And deeply.
And they're also usually and often abused and used by narcissism.
Absolutely.
And covert narcissism especially.
Yes.
Is there's that sort of perfect tool for the narcissist to use because there's so much sensitivity and there's so much sweetness around wanting to do the best thing for that person. And
yeah, they
and
can make you hate yourself if you don't do their bidding.
For sure. And it becomes really psychologically, it makes you ill. So
yes.
there's a lot of that I've seen. You know, with people that struggle with this particular part of their lives.
Sure.
But if you can say, it is a part of my life, but I get to choose when I use it.
Yes.
I think that's a beautiful place to be.
Right.
And I'm learning still as we speak.
Good.
Yeah.
So Jennifer, anything else that we haven't touched on about being sensitive that you think is really important to bring to the table before we finish here?
No, I just think it gets back to just recognizing that if it is something biological and from the moment we're born, that's a tool for like connection.
Right.
And that we want to be careful that we don't throw it off as a symptom of something bad.
Right.
That it's actually very useful for intimacy. It's seeing people.
Yes.
You know, and people get to see us too. And that's one of those things where without that, it's hard to be intimate.
But what if your parents are afraid of being seen? That's the scary thing from my perspective.
If your parents are afraid? Yeah.
Well, my parents were terrified of their shadow. Their pain. Because they were both so abused and so shamed as children.
Yes.
That, you know, they created so much magical thinking in order to cope. Right?
Yes.
My dad lived, as any Jewish person would, lusting after money. Because in his mind, if he had enough money, he would not have to deal with any of the pain in life.
Boy.
And so every time he made a ton of money, he would sabotage it to the point where we would go from being really wealthy to poor within a week or two.
Yeah. Wait, I wonder why that is.
Because he didn't feel like he deserved it.
I see.
And so he sabotaged it.
Sort of around his own self.
And the only thing that therapy ever did for him was get him to a place where he could actually enjoy being a criminal and not fuck it up. No, I'm serious.
That's
because he got to a place when he left my mom and got a new wife where they became fabulously wealthy as white-collar criminals.
Mm.
And he never sabotaged it like he did when he was with my mom. Mm,
interesting.
Because she enjoyed the money and the, mm-hmm. you know, the journey they were on together. And so they did really, really well. And my dad got to a place where he actually believed he deserved whatever he was able to create for himself.
Interesting.
But he'd never developed a conscience.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't have one of those, you're not going to get one.
You can get a yeah.
It's, right.
That's right.
So
that's right.
It was interesting to watch that change in him.
That's right. And as a kid,
yeah.
I mean, what did you take from that with your dad? You think
the only thing that I know this sounds weird, but the deepest connection I had with anybody was with my dad. even though
that's interesting.
My brother and my sister and my daughter, they couldn't stand the sight of him. I mean, my daughter as a little kid wouldn't go anywhere near my father. She was terrified of him.
Interesting.
And being a woman in his life was terrifying. Mm-hmm. And my brother got nothing from him. And my sister, being a girl, you know, knew my dad was a perv. So they got nothing from him in any way. Mm-hmm. But I used to steal my dad's clothes and wear them and take his robe and sleep with it because his scent was the only thing I could count on to help me feel secure.
Interesting.
Because my mom was so vacant that there was no connecting with her. She was like a ghost.
I see.
So
he was the only thing really that you had that potential
for me.
With.
But yeah. My sister and brother got nothing from him. And I don't think my brother talked to my dad for the last 20, 25 years of his life. And my sister died young, but my dad didn't even know that she had cancer. She had no connection to him.
Wow.
So I think some of it depends on which.
And that tells you a lot that people deal with things so different, yes. Right? And you maybe as that HSP maybe even chose to kind of move in towards him.
Well, he was, he was the only like adult person that I sort of felt some connection to.
Yes, and needed it.
But it wasn't much. Yeah. I can say that. I lived with a ton of feelings of abandonment. And all and it's hard to manage when you're a really sensitive person because you feel like it's all your fault.
I know.
It's really hard because I really did believe that.
You know, they say there's only 25% of the world that's highly sensitive people.
I think
that's about right.
I'm not sure that it's that high, to tell you the truth. At least to
be
in
the, like 25, a quarter.
The 90th or 95th percentile for people that are really sensitive.
Yes.
The people that find their way into your life and my life.
Yes.
Anyway, it doesn't really matter what the percentage is.
So interesting.
All that matters is that, you know, helping people understand their nature.
Yes, it's such a rewarding thing.
Super important.
Yes.
It's one of the funnest things that I see happen.
Yep. Watch them go, oh.
Yeah.
I see.
And some people get really mad because they think, especially men my age, you're telling me I'm a pussy. I think, no, not really.
It's okay to be a pussy.
It's okay.
It's okay.
You can't help it anyway.
You just got to say this after me. It's okay. Right?
I know it's
okay,
not a very nice term, but I hear that term regularly.
Well, but I mean to be able to say, it's okay that I'm that. That's okay. Like, who told you it was not okay?
Well,
I don't like the derogatoriness
parents,
of that. Right? That's derogatory.
Their symptom.
Yeah.
Everybody in their life is telling them it's not okay.
What does that mean? You know?
Yeah.
I know. It's like, you've got limits. You know, it's like you're affected by things. There's nothing wrong with that. Yeah.
Well, Jennifer, once again,
nice
it's been such a pleasure. You know,
same.
It's so fun talking with you because it just feels really good and
off the cuff.
And I'm so really glad that you are helping people embrace their HSP life because it's so, so important.
So important.
So again, I thank you.
Thank you, Dana.
We appreciate our listeners and are interested in your comments and suggestions. Feel free to email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. If you are interested in becoming a sponsor for this podcast, please email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. See you next time.